You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. The big people's tour for America on the road here in South Carolina, making our way from Rock Hill down to Charleston today. I wanted to spend a little time talking about Rock Hill. We drove into this cute little town. Just a picturesque little southern town that you go, just really an adorable place. And you think back to the history, which, you know, at the beginning of this year was kind of revived, if you will, as the attorney for the case back in 1961. The attorney for the case, a guy named Ernest Finney, also he was a retired state Supreme Court justice, back in January stood before the very court that convicted these nine Friendship Nine college students from Friendship College there in South Carolina, who had the audacity to sit down at the McCrory's lunch counter and the Crest lunch counter there in Rock Hill. And you go into the town, and it's interesting because, you know, I can't imagine there being two of these, you know, big department store kind of chains within a couple of blocks of each other in this small town. But as we've gone to these areas where these lunch counter protests occurred, they were almost right next to each other. The competitors were right almost next to each other. So you had competing lunch counters and little department stores. And it's an interesting look back to, you know, how things may have been, where in the town center you had this kind of economic engine. But you go back to this time in 1961, and I think it was January of 61 when this occurred. It was, you know, one of those mornings in January where, you know, I'm sure no one thought history was going to be made on the last day of January 1961, just after 11, as these nine college students show up at the Scent Variety Store there in Rock Hill. And understand, there's a number of these places around there. And the police, I guess, were already there waiting for them. So the second they sat down, they were arrested immediately for trespassing. And this was going on, as we found out, all across the South, starting in Greensboro. It just spread. When we went to the International Civil Rights Center there in Greensboro, they had this interactive kind of map on this table where they show, you know, ground zero being Greensboro. And from Greensboro, then this explosion across the South, where these sit-ins were happening all over. And I forget the numbers that they threw out at us, you know, tens of thousands of people participating in these sit-ins. And Rock Hill is special because all of the other ones up until this point, the civil rights people, the civil rights movement, the different organizations were paying the bail. So they were going, you get locked up, we'll come bail you out. What was different about this one What was different here is that they weren't going to pay the $100 fine. They weren't going to pay the bail and all of that. They were going to go to jail. And it's an interesting time because then what happens is now you've shifted the costs from the civil rights movement and these different various groups onto the local municipalities, because now they've got to house these people. Now they've got to lock them up. Now they've got to feed them. Now they've got to deal with them. And they don't really have the facilities to do this. Now, these nine kids, these nine college students from Friendship College there, they were sentenced to a $100 fine or 30 days in the workhouse. And it's interesting because, you know, back at the beginning of 2015, what had happened was you had the prosecutor, the 16th Circuit solicitor, this guy named Kevin Brackett of Rock Hill, saying that, you know what, we need to pursue this. We need to wipe this off the record, to write history, if you will. Citing Dr. King's The Arc of Moral, the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. They pushed for this, to have this taken away. And it's not about rewriting history, as the judge said. It's about writing history. And the judge, this municipal judge, Jane Pittman Modell, she read the official court records against them and the charges. The offense was trespassing. The disposition was guilty. The sentence was $100 or 30 days in jail. Now, go back to 1960. 1961, $100 is a lot of money. It's a month of your life in prison. And what ended up happening, they were sent to a chain gang. And it's interesting, in the stories that I've read about this moment, the attorney who defended these guys back in 1969, this Ernest Finney, who, as I said, was a retired state Supreme Court justice, you know, he enters this motion. Now they got to prop this guy up. He's 83 years old. And think about how, you know, he's a 33-year-old lawyer defending these guys. He's an 83-year-old guy now being propped up. He's, you know, holding himself up on the table, and he says, "May it please the court, today I'm honored and proud to move this honorable court to vacate the conviction of my clients. These courageous and determined South Carolinians have shown by their conduct and their faith that the relief that they seek should be granted. I move for the convictions entered in 1961 be vacated." And the prosecutor in the case, Mr. Brackett, he chimes in because, you know, he probably should have just said, you know what, we're just going to leave it with him. But he says, no, the record is abundantly clear. There's only one reason for these men to have been arrested. There's only one reason that they were charged and convicted for trespassing, and that's because they were black. This could not happen today. It was wrong then. It was wrong today. These convictions, if allowed to stand, would be an offense to justice, and they must be vacated. He went on to say that these nine were his heroes and extended an appreciation for their bravery. He said, "Our community here, our country, is a better place because of what y'all did. It's a better place for me. It's a better place for my daughter. And for that, I owe you my thanks." And the circuit judge, John C. Hayes III, which another one of these interesting moments where you look back at the people who, the things that they did in the past, it's their children and grandchildren and their relatives who are the ones who are cleaning up after them. John C. Hayes III is the nephew of the judge who sentenced these nine almost 5.5 decades ago. And he announced that these sentences would be officially vacated. And you think about this, you know, it takes this long. And, you know, while I agree with the idea that the arc of history, of the moral universe is long and tends towards progress, I look at this as one of those, yeah, it tends towards progress, but the reality is this has been a long bit. And, you know, here's the thing, and this is kind of why we're doing this trip. I knew nothing about the Friendship Nine. I knew nothing about the jail no bail movement. It makes sense. You know, I know about it in the labor movement. They did this back during the Bread and Roses strike in the 1912s. You go back and you look at this stuff, and one one movement, the other movement. They seem to me to be inextricably linked in the struggle for progress, in the struggle for what is right, and in the struggle to move forward. So today we're going to be talking about what South Carolina. We're going to be heading down to Charleston. There's some interesting stuff down there. The 1969 hospital worker strike is the big one for me because it's a labor issue. I've known about it for a number of years, and it's one of those things that'll be, to me, it's worth looking into because of the people that we'll get to meet and to hear their stories, people who are still alive today. So I'm looking forward to that as we make our way from Rock Hill all the way down to Charleston to share some of the stories there and talk about that. So if you've got any thoughts, any questions, any comments, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can follow us along at hashtag People's Tour, also on thericksmithshow.com. You can check out where we've been, where we're going, what we're doing, all of that stuff right there. Let's take a quick break right back after this. From South Carolina, the People's Tour for America.
The sound that you're listening to is from my guitar that's named Lucille.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they forgot to kill went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. People's Tour for America rolling through South Carolina, made our way to Charleston. And I got to tell you, I love the state, just really hot. A beautiful state, just really, really hot. And earlier this morning, I had an opportunity to walk through Hamilton Park. And Professor Kerry Taylor was our tour guide that showed us around this beautiful park. Amazing place that really has a dark history in my view, which is why I've asked Kerry Taylor to sit down with us. Kerry, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, absolutely.
So you took us to this wonderfully beautiful park that you would, you know, on a sunny day, you go and you have a picnic, and it's just a beautiful place. Wow, the history that you shared with us, just mind-blowing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, Rick, you know, when I take my students or take people from out of town and show them Hampton Park, I like to think of the park as, you know, an important space in which there's been a long kind of history of struggle over over that space and who controls that space. And, you know, I'd mentioned to you that in the 19th century, Hampton Park was known as the Washington Race Course. And this was every year during the season in the early spring, the planters from all over the Carolinas and Georgia.
The wealthy.
The wealthy. These were slave owners, slaveholders, plantation owners, and other powerful people in the South would come they would descend on the Washington Race Course, and they would you know, this became an event of the season. It was a place for them to socialize, to transact business, and it was all centered around the competition, the horse races. So, you know, so the Washington Race Course had, you know, it was, I suppose, you know, it was part of an important part of the planters' social culture or social lives. During the Civil War, it became a prison camp for imprisoned Union soldiers.
So how do you turn a park into a prison?
Well, it was, I think it was, you know, from what we understand, it was an open air, you know, there wasn't much to it. It was an open air prison. So, you know, you'd put
just laying on the ground out in the
for
elements.
The most part. And I'd imagine, you know, living in lean-tos or whatever the prisoners could fashion. My understanding is that the officers were allowed to live under what had been the grandstand for the race course. So they had some, you know, structure that provided some shelter from the elements. But, you know, the soldiers would, you know, just have to make do. Now, these were prisoners who had already suffered through, you know, really the travesty and the inhumane conditions of the Andersonville prison in Georgia. And as Sherman was, you know, invading Georgia, Andersonville was evacuated because it was, you know, I think probably both for strategic reasons, but it was also a political liability. The numbers of people who perished in Andersonville were just, you know, extraordinary. So the prisoners had to be dispersed and evacuated to other prisons throughout the South, one of which was Charleston. There were various sites where these prisoners were relocated to in Charleston, but one of the main ones was there in the Washington Race Course.
Was it this beautiful park that we saw today?
It is a beautiful park today. And, you know, you can, you know, it certainly didn't have those, you know, certainly, you know, as a prison, at least, I'm sure it was, you know, not a very, you know, pleasant place to be.
Right. But we were standing on this ground.
That's right.
And as soon as you said, you know, at one point, these prisoners are in this prison and some of them perish in, some of them die in this facility. And then they took all these people and they buried them in a mass grave. And oh, by the way, you said right on the ground you're standing on. And immediately I looked down and I'm thinking of this. Are they still here? Mm-hmm. And you said, no, that fortunately they were dug up.
Yeah. So about 200 of them died, you know, in the final months, closing months of the war, and they were buried in a mass unmarked grave. Now, after emancipation and as Charleston is liberated at the tail end of the Civil War, the black community of Charleston, including the recently freed men and women, as well as some free people of color, about 10,000 of them in a procession came, you know, marched through the city and came to the Washington Racecourse to honor their liberators. And they put up a fence around the what they had done was they disinterred the bodies and gave them all a proper burial. And they called it the Cemetery for the Martyrs of the Racecourse. So they're recognizing them as their liberators, and turned that moment into a political celebration, a celebration of their freedom, a celebration of the freedom struggle. And they sang freedom songs. You had representatives of the colored military units were part of that procession, you know, as were processions of workers. Ministers gave political speeches. There were, you know, big contingents of children. And in that sense, what had been, you can imagine how this played with white people, especially the white planters, for whom Hampton Park had been, or
their space,
Washington, that had been their space. But this was, you know, an example of, you know, the freed people claiming it as black space and saying this is sacred ground. This is ours. And that kind of struggle, I think that's emblematic of a larger struggle that took place over the next 12 years during what we refer to as Reconstruction. And a lot of that work was centered here in the Lowcountry, because the Lowcountry, or at least Beaufort, was liberated by the Union troops just months into the Civil War. And that became known throughout the Black South. And you had, you know, thousands of enslaved men and women leaving their plantations, headed to the Lowcountry of South Carolina, where they knew that they could enjoy their freedom. And so, you know, under federal occupation, then what you had is, you know, what I sometimes refer to as kind of like Mississippi Freedom Summer, but 100 years before Mississippi Freedom Summer, because you had an influx of political and religious radicals coming from, white radicals coming from Philadelphia and New York, to be part of what's referred to as the Port Royal Experiment. And what you had is, you know, the kind of the nation's first effort at trying to forge a biracial democracy, trying to articulate, you know, what is the economy going to look like? What will our political system look like? Our social system look like? What will that look like under emancipation? And you begin to see people plot, you know, wrestling with that, struggling with that in the Beaufort, you know, area up to, you know, here in Charleston.
And it's, you know, my education takes me into that period, you know, and things were seemed to be going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. That you seem to see people coming together. There were lots of opportunities for folks. And then everything seemed to change. And we took a wrongward turn in a big way.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's, you know, for 12 years, and I think the key here is, I mean, it was always a struggle. You know, the defeated white South never gave up.
But as we found out, I mean, there were elected black representatives from South Carolina during this period, where there was at least some attempt at some representation, at least an attempt at bringing the failures of our Constitution into line.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, it was always, you know, contested and challenged. But ultimately in 1877, by 1877, really the federal government lost the will to sustain Reconstruction. The troops were removed as part of the compromise of 1877, and the Reconstruction governments collapsed in the southern states in which they remained, you know, where they had gained a toehold. And, you know, what, you know, ensued over the next 20 years, 30 years, unevenly, but nevertheless, you know, consistently there's a movement toward Jim Crow segregation. And by 1900, that becomes, really the it's deeply embedded in, Southern politics and Southern social life.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Kerry Taylor. He's a professor of history at the Citadel here in Charleston. You know, Kerry, I want to go back to the park for a second.
Sure.
Because, you know, as you were walking us through this beautiful park with the big gazebos and all of this and the big pond in the middle and all of this, there is a statue of someone named Denmark Vesey, someone whom I had never heard of until I started doing some planning for this tour. But you look at that now and you go, interesting place for a statue of Mr. Vesey, given his history. Can you tell us a little bit about about the man?
Sure. Denmark Vesey was born in the Caribbean. It's not exactly clear where. He was enslaved, and the man who owned him was a ship's captain, and he seemed to have had a close relationship with Captain Vesey, under whom he gained some kind of training. He was, you know, highly literate, recognized for his leadership ability even as an enslaved man. Denmark Vesey at some point won a street lottery and was able to purchase his own freedom through that. So he became a free person of color, which, you know, in Charleston had a significant population of free people of color who, while they did not enjoy all of the, you know, they didn't enjoy social and political equality necessarily, they were not enslaved, and they enjoyed, you know, some level of, some expression of freedom, you know, not freedom by our, you know, modern standards. But nevertheless, Denmark Vesey in 1822 was implicated in a conspiracy to overthrow slavery, to commandeer a ship and to return, his family and whoever he could take aboard to travel to Haiti. And
Why Haiti?
Because Haiti had gone through a revolution, and it was felt that, it was there that they could enjoy freedom and equality in a post-colonial Haiti. He would have also, you know, had firsthand knowledge of Haiti and the Caribbean, having been born there.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's not entirely clear what the, you know, what the end goal was, but the conspiracy was discovered.
But just him getting on a boat and leaving town isn't enough to put him into the bit of history that the controversial bit of history that we find around him.
That's right. So I mean, yeah, he
was going to kill Whitey.
He becomes an outlaw. Well, that was
that was what was alleged.
Yeah. That was,
because I got to be honest. If I'm killing the guy too.
Yeah.
At least that's my thought.
No. I mean, once you make that first move to secure your freedom, you've got a target on you. And
history kind of remembers him as we were talking. History, you know, it depends on where you fall. He's either a liberator and or a freedom fighter, or he's a terrorist, or is he a scapegoat?
That's right. It could have been it. And among historians, there is some debate as to how real this conspiracy actually was. There's some suggestion that it was, it became a kind of political scheme that was fueled by the paranoia and the very real white fears of a slave uprising or revolt. So Vesey is, as I said, the conspiracy is found out, and he and his co-conspirators were tried and put to death. So his memory, you know, since 1822 then has been hotly contested. And, as you said, on, you know, one, you know, among African-Americans, he's a symbol of struggle, a symbol of hope, a symbol of strength. And, but then he's, you know, in the eyes of most whites, he's, you know, been demonized and is a terrorist and a bad, bad person. So it took a period of over 20 years. A community group has waged a battle in order to commemorate Vasey. And, you know, that took a real grassroots effort. It took a lot of it took a lot of energy. People put a lot of time into that. And within, I think it's been up for about a year and a half now, there has, you know, this very nice commemorative statue has been erected to Denmark Vasey. And there's, you know, really nice text that tells, you know, the story behind the conspiracy and tells a little bit about the life of Denmark Vasey.
Yeah, why, you're thinking 1822, you think today, why now? I mean, why go after all these years? Why now?
Yeah, some of it I think is you know, kind of the changed demographics of Charleston, that maybe you have fewer people who are invested in you know, the invested in, I think, you know, frankly, racist notions of what the South is. So I think there probably is some new openness on the part of you know, most South Carolinians for a you know, kind of more open consideration of our history, of our past. We're seeing some of that in the historic plantations around the area are trying to, you know, do a better job of representing African-American life.
Right.
And you see that in all of the local museums and commemorative sites. So I think, you know, part of that is... you know, I think it's the changed demographics, as I've said. I think there's probably, to some degree, it's a recognition on the part of museum professionals that there are emerging markets for a more honest and accurate, you know, for truth-telling
right.
in history. So that's part of it. And, you know, going back to the struggle, you know, these were, you know, folks at the local level that made this happen and have pushed to make that happen.
Good,
so it's,
good grassroots organizing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So last question I've got for you. You know, the park is now named Hampton Park. You were saying it was the race park before. How did it become Hampton Park and
yeah.
why?
Well, that's right. And I think that sort of corresponds to, you know, the going back to the politics of Reconstruction. So Reconstruction, you know, comes to an end at the federal level in 1877. You have... you know, Jim Crow becomes a reality in the late 19th century. And so the park in the, I believe Hampton Park is commemorated in the, I don't have the precise year, but it's in the early part of the 20th century. So as Jim Crow, segregation is becoming a reality throughout the South and really much of the country, I should add. You know, Hampton Park is named Hampton Park. And I think that becomes then a sort of a reclaiming of Hampton Park as white space by naming Hampton Park after the former governor of South Carolina, but also the champion of the red shirt movement, which was the political effort to overthrow the biracial Republican government and overthrow the Reconstruction, you know, politics of the 1870s. So in a very kind of outward you know, that the naming of Hampton, it's not just, we're not just honoring any former governor or, you know, honoring a great
There was
man.
A lot of thought behind that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They knew what they were doing. It's like I've heard with the Confederate battle flag.
Mm-hmm.
It saw its interest grow during the Civil War or during the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, during the 40s and 50s, when all this stuff is happening, you see a lot of activity around that big
right.
blue X.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's, yeah, for South Carolina, it's, you know, I believe it's 1962 when the, you know, the Confederate flag returns to the State House grounds.
So, it's just an amazing story. Professor Taylor, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thank you so much for your time and thank you for the tour.
Good. No, I enjoyed it too.
Well, let's take a quick break here from Charleston, South Carolina. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. On the talk.
not the Atchison, Topeka, not the Chattanooga choo-choo, nor the one that leaves at midnight for the state of Alabama.
This song is a train song where the engineer is Uncle Sam.
Here comes the freedom train, you better hurry down. Just like Paul Revere, it's coming into your hometown.
Inside the freedom train, you'll find a precious freight. Those words of liberty, the documents that made us great.
You can shout your anger from a steeple. You can shoot the system full of holes.
You can always question we the people.
You can get your answer at the poll.
That's how it's always been, and how it will remain.
As long as all of us keep riding on the freedom train. Johnny Mercer,
Peggy Lee,
Benny Goodman,
Margaret Whiting,
the Pipers and the Western Band.
Sitting on the observation, spreading freedom through the land.
You can write the president a letter. You can even tell him to his face. If you think that you can do it better, get the votes and you can take his place. The laws that you're obeying, you can shout your anger to the crowd. We may disagree with what you're saying, but we'll fight to let you say it loud.
That's how it's always been.
That's the way it's gonna remain. As long as all of us
keep riding on the freedom train.
Riding, riding.
Show.com. Also, check out the site there for where we've been, where we're going on the People's Tour for America. Also, hashtag People's Tour. Lots of videos, lots of audio up there for you to take a look at, and you can follow us along. I'm here at the International Longshore Association Union Hall here in Charleston, South Carolina. The good folks here at the ILA have been generous enough and wonderful enough to invite us into their hall to talk about labor and the South and the civil rights movement. And I'm sitting here with Dr. Kerry Taylor. He is a professor of history over at the Citadel here in Charleston. Professor Taylor, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, we think about the civil rights movement, we think of the South because this is where all this stuff happened. You really think of Mississippi and Alabama and, you know, Atlanta, certainly South Carolina a little bit. But when you think about labor, the South is not where a lot of people think. And there have been, as we've been making our trip, there have been a lot of very significant events in labor's history, along with the civil rights history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, Rick. And you know, I don't think we can separate them. You know, the history, especially when we think about the Carolinas, but think about Charleston in particular. The labor movement and the civil rights movement have always been inextricably linked. And, you know, while, you know, from a Pennsylvania perspective or a Illinois or a California perspective, we wouldn't think of the Carolinas really as, you know, registering in our you know, our understanding of American labor history. But nevertheless, you know, what I've argued is that really South Carolina has played a central role in at several pivotal moments in American labor history.
Right. And, I think a lot of people would agree, but I think a lot of people would say it's always been from the negative end, where we've been pitted against each other, because this is part of that divide between civil rights and labor rights and women's rights and consumer rights and all of these different things. We've been sliced up and pitted against one another, that we're led to believe our interests are mutually exclusive of all the other, when the reality is there's numerous intersections and overlap.
Yeah, and you know, without glossing over any of the difficulties at all, and in any of the defeats, which are real, South Carolina and North Carolina, at least in the recent past, have battled one another for the lowest rates of union concentration in the country. So, you know, the labor movement is frankly marginal in South Carolina. But
North Carolina is number one, but Nikki Haley's working on it. She's got her pointy shoes.
That's right. So in South Carolina, you know, we can go back to the politics of Reconstruction, which was, you know, it was really at the center of that was a discussion, a conversation over what will labor look like post-emancipation. You know, how will black people make a living? Right. And you know, there was a whole wave of strikes that took place in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, in which mostly day laborers were in the 1870s.
Before we knew what organized labor was and all of that, you had this organizing of workers going on, call it whatever you want.
Absolutely.
They were saying, you know, we want a bigger piece of the pie for ourselves.
Yep. Absolutely. That continues through industrialization. So, you know, not many people remember this or realize this, but in the 1934 general textile strike, at that time, it was probably 400,000 or 500,000 workers went out on strike during the general textile strike. And that strike was centered here in the Carolinas. You know, this is the largest strike in U.S. labor history, and the most militant workers are here in the South. In fact, it was, you know, when the union was meeting decide whether or not to go on strike, it was Alabama textile workers that went out prematurely before the International called for the strike, and that sort of forced the hand of the rest of the union to follow suit. That strike ended, it was brutally suppressed by the state. You know, workers were put in camps in a penitentiary in outside of Atlanta that had been used to detain prisoners of war during the First World War. And these are American workers, women and children, textile workers, who are put in these camps for, you know, having taken part.
Yeah, how dare you want better wages?
That's right.
How dare you want better conditions?
And these women had been part of these flying squadrons that would move from milltown to milltown, calling the workers out of the plants to join the general textile strike. So that strike, you know, the Carolinas play a key role in that in the upstate. And then kind of, you know, fast forwarding to 1969, here in Charleston, you had a merger of civil rights and labor, quite literally through the cooperation of Local 1199 came down from New York City. They were looking to establish a kind of beachhead in the South from which to launch a broader effort to organize the South. So 1199 sent organizers to Charleston. SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was Martin Luther King's organizational expression throughout, you know, his public career, SCLC came over from Atlanta, and they worked with the workers here at the Medical College of Charleston. And they went on strike for over 3 months, for 100 days, those workers. They were joined by other hospital workers at the county hospital here in town in carrying out that strike. It did not end in a, you know, it ended with an agreement. The workers were given raises. There was a new grievance procedure that
was
implemented.
But there was no union recognition, as I remember.
But no official union recognition. There was some, I think, a concession made to allow for a checkoff. But 1199 was not able to sustain itself in the South. They did, however, use Charleston and what had taken place in Charleston to organize a number of other hospitals, including Johns Hopkins in Baltimore in 1916, right about that same time.
Right.
And it sort of that Charleston in some ways became kind of the launching pad for 1199's largest period of expansion and growth in the late 60s and in 1970s.
So you could probably make the argument that some of the great growth came out of things that happened here, because as I remember you saying, you know, in 1934, with this textile strike that was going on and the brutal repression and the conditions and all of this stuff ended up then, you know, you started the commission, the Wagner Commission was looking into what eventually became the Wagner Act.
That's right. That's right. And
see, now I've heard that story that, this being part of it, also the coal mines in Pennsylvania being part of it as well.
That's right. And I'm in San Francisco, I think the longshoremen might tell a little bit different version of the story.
But the reality was, is it didn't matter. There was brutal repression against any workers of this time period who wanted to get a little bit of the pie.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it you know, a very broad upsurge in 1934, you know, with the strike in San Francisco, the Teamsters in Minneapolis, and the textile strike. All of that is going to inform the formation of the Wagner Act. You know,
and this is exactly what I talk about, you know, and I tell people, you know, during the Great Depression, this country was literally being torn apart brick by brick because people were hungry. Their stomachs were empty. Their kids were going to bed hungry at night. And they were saying, wait a minute, we're working our behinds off. Someone's making money off of this. Someone's getting rich. We deserve a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that came that organizing. And I see a lot of those same components coming together today where people are saying the same things. I've been working harder and harder. We're falling further and further behind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since 2008, the Center for American Progress did a study that said, you know, from 2008 until 2012, that period of time, working families have fallen so far behind that it cost about $10,000 or more, about $10,000 a year just to stay where you were. So you've fallen backwards in wages.
Yeah.
Just, you know, for rent and food
for
and clothing
sure.
and all that stuff.
No, and we're seeing, you know, some of that. I mean, I think coming through, like, the rhetoric around Occupy and now the, you know, the fight for 15, the, you know, the effort among.
And I think they got it right, 15 in a union.
Yep, spearheaded by the fast food workers demanding a $15 minimum wage and union recognition. I think they're starting to change some of the rhetoric, and we're seeing some of the, you know, at the state level and some municipalities are implementing you know, higher minimum wages, local minimum wages, state minimum wages. And that's in response to this popular upsurge.
And what I love about the fast food workers, that wasn't an institutional organizing. That literally came from the grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
And it has spread across this country like wildfire.
Yeah, yeah. No, we've had a pretty robust Charleston expression of the fast food campaign and, you know, workers who've you know, taken local leadership and then also, you know, participated in the regional and national events too. So no, that's been, and it's also, you know, one other aspect of that is that I think it's enlivened a lot of other kind of grassroots activities that are taking place around the South. So we have, you know, fast food workers who've, you know, participated in, you know, our local community groups have gotten involved in things, you know, beyond just their, you know, more narrow focus on their industry or their job. You know, so you see a lot of crossover, for instance, between the fast food workers and Black Lives Matter.
Right.
You know, I think that's, you know, these are hopeful developments.
It's interesting times, to say the least. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Kerry Taylor. He's the professor of history over at the Citadel here in Charleston, talking a little bit about Charleston's labor history. And I got to tell you, you took us around and we saw that there were historical markers commemorating the cigar workers, commemorating the hospital workers. And you said there were a couple others around the area. And I'm immediately thinking, wow, in Charleston, they've got these great markers. Where in Pennsylvania, it's a Herculean leap to remember some of our history and to get markers put on the streets. Yeah. I'm sure there had to be resistance to putting those up because those are actually some bits of positive history.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that there was resistance might be strong. I know that at the hospital there were some concerns coming from the administration about the specific wording of that marker.
Right.
And, I think they took a strong interest in that process. They wanted
their spin, sure.
They wanted their spin. They wanted to protect their institutional interests by making sure that the wild-eyed radicals didn't write the text.
And that they didn't look as bad as they were.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I don't know that there have been active resistance. Now, there was resistance to the erection of the Denmark Vesey marker, which we talked about earlier. That was a long battle, but I don't think there was resistance to maybe if American Tobacco still had a factory here in town, there may have been resistance.
But again, you could probably look at it where there's not much of a threat, then yeah, you can have your little marker.
I think that's what it is.
And speaking of the cigar factory, I mean, there, another one of those moments of organizing that can happen and has happened.
That's right. And I think I haven't found any other instance. You know, that was a strike that took place in tail end of 1945 into 1946. And that was, at least from what I've found, that was probably the largest interracial strike in South Carolina, at least until that time, that I've found evidence of. And that was a strike of mostly African-American women, but they were joined on the picket lines by some white men and women and African-American men. And that was a strike against their employer, the American Tobacco Company. And that strike is also, to the degree that that strike is remembered in popular memory, it's because of the gospel song that was sung by the picketers on the streets in front of the factory, the women sang a gospel song, "I Shall Overcome." And it was Zilphia Horton and others who were affiliated with the Highlander Folk School, which at the time was a training center for the CIO. Zilphia was the musical director at Highlander, and she introduced "I Shall Overcome" first into the labor movement, and then, of course, later that became adapted
the anthem of the civil rights movement.
That's right, as "We Shall Overcome," and it was Pete Seeger and Guy Carawan play a key role in popularizing that among civil rights workers, and then moving beyond the American civil rights movement, then that becomes an international freedom anthem that's sung during the solidarity protests in Poland and during the South African liberation struggle. And so in that sense, it's kind of Charleston's musical gift, one of Charleston's musical gifts to the world, but Charleston's musical gift to freedom struggles, throughout the globe.
Amazing stuff. And that's the reason we've taken this tour, and we're looking for those stories. And it's we've had an amazing time here of finding these things and discovering them. And I want to thank you for taking a little time for us and showing us around.
Happy to do it.
Thank you so much, Professor. Professor Kerry Taylor, he's a history professor over at the Citadel here in Charleston. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
guitar mic, please. Guitar mic. My heart when I need my brother.